What's up, everyone? Welcome to the Web3 with a Splash of Wine podcast, where we talk about blockchain technology, DeFi, NFTs, and all kinds of other Web3 vibes. This show is for entertainment purposes only, and nothing said on the podcast should be taken as financial or legal advice. Let's dive into it. GM, everyone, and welcome to the Web3 with a Splash of Lime podcast. I'm your host, Zhivko, part of Lime Chain, a blockchain development company and co-founder of EnterDAO. And today with me, I have a really special guest, Mike Levy. Mike is a prolific NFT collector, and he's also a co-founder of a DeFi and NFT platform called Floaty. Welcome to the show, Mike. I'm glad to have you on.
Thank you very much, GM. Excited to be on. Thank you for having me.
Oh, pleasure is mine. All right, so let's dive straight into it. Like, would love to get you basically your story on how you got into crypto and NFTs, because I know you're a big collector. You're one of the first guys that got into Top Shot, and you also featured in the Wall Street Journal or whatnot, but would love to get the story from you so the audience get a sense of how you got into all of this.
Yeah, absolutely. So I come from a finance background. I did kind of traditional corporate finance work in the U.S. I'm New York based. I studied finance and statistics at undergrad. And then in about 2017, I decided to kind of take the dive into crypto itself and bought Bitcoin and Ethereum in a pretty passive way. I just bought it and kept it in Coinbase. I didn't really dive into anything beyond that. And really didn't know there was much beyond that at that point. When things changed for me was in September of 2020. I was scrolling through Twitter. It was in the middle of lockdown during COVID, and I came across a tweet that basically described that the NBA had released a new sort of collectible project, and it was digital collectibles. And I thought it was pretty interesting and pretty compelling, and what it sort of tapped into for me was the discussion I had with a lot of people about Bitcoin back in 2017, which was basically Bitcoin is in many ways a better version of gold in that it's easier to transact with. You can subdivide it. You can actually genuinely use it to transact. You can't take a bar of gold and go to Starbucks and buy coffee with it. They're not going to accept that. But going forward, you can hopefully actually use crypto to transact. But anyway, I was very comfortable with the idea of assigning value to a digital asset. And so I'm a big sports fan. I'm someone who's interested in new markets and taking risks and things like that. So I decided to join the platform in September of 2020. And I did a very, very deep dive at that point. So I looked into Dapper Labs. I learned at that point that Dapper Labs was behind the CryptoKitties project, which was the project that was the first ERC-721 project. That came right after CryptoPunks, and that the Dapper Labs team was very, very experienced in the space, very well known in the space. They had VC investment, they had NBA player investment, they had an NBA license, and some of the biggest names in the NFT space were early adopters of the platform. And so to me, all that kind of made sense. And then I looked at my own example where I was really enjoying the platform, and I was coming in as a normie, mainstream type person. And so I thought, this is really, really going to work. I'm having a lot of fun on this. It's going to be popular, and invested very aggressively in Top Shot. So today I have the largest individually owned Top Shot account by value, which is exciting and fun. I'm very bullish on the platform. I've actually never withdrawn from the platform, and think it's a lot of fun, having a good time with it. But where I think that was really exciting for me beyond the value created was it was my launch into the NFT space. So since then, I've gotten involved with a lot of different projects. I'm fortunate to own a few CryptoPunks. I own a Ferocious piece. I own a Beeple piece. I own quite a bit of other art and NFT collections that I'm happy to touch on. But that was sort of my journey. And I've spent the last year and a quarter basically getting as deep into the space as possible, getting involved in the development side, meeting everyone I can, meeting founders, learning about the different blockchains. And I love it.
Nice. No, appreciate the story, and it's definitely an interesting journey. And the things that you've basically, not the things that you've accomplished, but basically the collection that you've amassed in the NFT space is quite impressive. And just to play devil's advocate here for a bit, because I've tried to explain DopShot to some of my normie friends, and you've heard this a ton of times, but they always come up with this like, hey, what's the difference if I basically download this highlight from YouTube? So could you touch upon that? What makes the NBA Top Shot special as a piece of, even as an asset?
Yeah, so I think what makes Top Shot special taps into kind of the general societal value on intangible objects. So there are objects that lack intrinsic value that still have monetary value. And that's been the case from the very early days of humanity. Things like gold, things like, you know, special types of beans way back in the day. Art, of course, has always carried value. The idea of providing entertainment, for example. When you go to a movie, when you go to anything else, you don't get any tangible monetary gain. You don't get food. You don't get financial gains. You get an experience. And so there is a big part of the world today, an existing part of the world, well before blockchain, well before digital collectibles, that values stamps, not because of they can be used to send mail, but because they're rare, they're scarce, anything else like that. Stamps, sports cards, art, old cars that may not even run anymore. And if you kind of break down the value components of these collectibles, it has very, very little to do with the actual experience of looking at them or the experience of touching and feeling them. So we can talk about sports cards, for example. So there are some sports cards that are worth, let's call it $5 million or $10 million. And at the end of the day, if you break it down, they're a piece of cardboard with an image that I can see anywhere. You can see it on Google. If you go to the Louvre in France, you can get a mug with a picture of the Mona Lisa on it. You can have the experience of looking at and seeing the piece of art. Despite that, the piece of art is worth a lot of money because it is the object that an artist basically said, this is mine. I've touched this directly. When it comes to a sports card, it's licensed by the league. It has stated and known scarcity, and it's authentic. And so it's not really about the experience of looking at and seeing a Mickey Mantle card or looking at and seeing a Mike Trout card or a LeBron James card. It's about the fact that it's endorsed by the league, it's licensed by the league, it's known, it has known scarcity, there's known authenticity. And again, the actual experience here, I've got, I guess there's a video component here, I've got a card right here. Nice. This you can look at, you can Google this exact card. The fact that mine is on cardboard isn't what makes it valuable. It's the fact that the MLB said, this is a real card. The company manufactured it, that Shohei Ohtani, the player on there, has signed an agreement saying this is authentic. And that's what people ultimately value. And not to go off on too much of a tangent, but there was an interesting study done in, I think it was 2014 by a college in New York. And what they basically asked people was, let's assume you have the Mona Lisa, the original Mona Lisa, and someone made an exact copy of it. So there's no way to distinguish between the two. The brushstrokes look the same. The frame is the same. Any fraying is the same. Any like aging spots are the exact same. Scientists can't tell the difference. Experts can't tell the difference. But you know, this is the original. This is the replica version. If the original burned down in a fire and you just had ashes left over, and that's it, just a pile of ashes, or this replica, that was, you know, it's a replica version. Which one would you rather go see in a museum? Would you rather see a pile of ashes of the original Mona Lisa or the replica version that you know isn't the original but looks the same? And something like 80 or 85% of people said they'd rather see the ashes of the original because it has the story, you know what the art looks like, it's more interesting, it's more compelling. And I think that really taps into the fact that it has very little to do with actually watching the play on YouTube. What's exciting about it is the story, when it was released, how many editions there are, who owns them, who's owned them before, what the markets treated them as. And so that concept, I think, resonates in a lot of parts of society. So I don't think it's different with digital assets. I do think if your friends say, I don't see the value of art, stamps, collectibles, old cars, anything, you name it, that lacks intrinsic value, then it'll be difficult for them to get comfortable with a digital collectible. But anyone who's comfortable with a physical collectible, I think, can eventually understand why a digital asset may have value.
No, absolutely. And I think this was one of the best explanations that I've heard of basically why digital collectibles have value. And it's been fascinating over the, because NFTs have been around for a few years, 3 or 4 years, but they really picked up speed in the last year or so. And it's fascinating to see all these markets being created around them. Both on like platforms like OpenSea and Topshot, because then part of owning these NFTs is just because there's a huge market around it and people are excited to participate in it. And I know you come from a traditional finance background. Were you basically surprised by how quick and how fast these markets developed, or you always knew there was something behind it?
I would say, I am surprised at the speed of growth. At the end of the day, people like to do things that are, that basically have gambling-like elements to them. People like that. Humans like that. You know, an element of the stock market is the ability to invest and kind of watch how it moves day to day. Like, I have no intention of selling any of the stocks I own, but I still check in how they're performing. It's fun. When it goes up, you feel like you're winning. You feel like you were right. It confirms and validates your initial thesis. And so there are really, really big elements of underlying gambling and collecting in the NFT space. And so I think, you know, you mentioned the Wall Street Journal article before, for example. That article was basically about the fact that I've made a lot of money on NBA Top Shot, and somewhat about Top Shot itself. Less about this is an exciting new concept for basketball fans and for NBA fans, much more about Mike made this much money doing it. And I think that is part of the reason why the industry blew up as quickly as it did, because there's a huge network effect. You know, people are making a lot of money. They're excited about it. They're telling their friends, they're telling their family. It's super, super easy to make money right now. And the underlying product almost gets lost in the shuffle. It doesn't matter whether it's trading sneakers, trading concert tickets, trading NFTs. People like the idea of basically being able to risk money in order to make more money. And that was very, very popular in the NFT space. For me, as someone who really likes the underlying technology, the collectible side of it, sees the future value of it from a collector and a sports fan and many other standpoints, I kind of look forward to the time when it's not just a large casino and people need to be more discerning and say, I like this piece of art because I like the artist's story, or I like this collectible because I'm a big basketball fan and I like the idea of getting free tickets or free merchandise or meeting a player or anything like that. And less so, my friend told me I can make a lot of money, so that's why I'm doing NFTs. And so I sort of look forward to the time when things calm down a little bit and the true value of the underlying technology can start to shine through.
Absolutely. And I'm glad that you touched on basically the thing about Wall Street Journal, that obviously a lot of the hype around the space is just because there is a big financial upside to it and people are looking at that. But something which I think often doesn't get enough credit or isn't talked about enough is the community side of thing. And basically, when you own a certain NFT, when you're part of a certain collection and everything, you get to be a part of community. And what triggers this viral effect of NFTs and their growth as an industry is that humans by nature are like social creatures, and they have a need to belong to a certain group, and they find themselves, so they want to belong to a certain internet subculture, and this is why people ape into a lot of these NFTs. And there's a number of examples like punks initially, Bored Apes and whatnot. Now everybody wants to be part of, basically it was the same when I was a kid and we were collecting these all kinds of cards and Pokemons in school. And I wanted, when I went to school and saw that like the kid next to me had a cool thing, like I wanted the same thing and wanted to be part of this cool group. And we're basically seeing the same thing over and over again, just on a bigger scale, because of technology and with a huge financial market around it. But with that, it comes challenges. Like obviously NFTs are assets, but they're relatively illiquid assets. And we're currently in the dawn of starting to see different financial instruments arise around the NFTs. And I know that you were working on something in that direction called Floaty. And I want to segue kind of into that. and basically start with an elevator pitch from you on what Float is and why you're building it.
So that I would love to do that and appreciate the opportunity to chat. And I do want to touch base also on what you mentioned about the community side of it. So that's part of the aspect that I really, really like about the space. And especially when you look at the global nature of it, where if you look in your local town, you might find a few people who have overlapping interests and values to what you do. If you look in your country or your state, you might find a lot more. But if you look across the whole world, I think that that's what NFTs have allowed people to do, similar to, Reddit communities almost, or Facebook groups or things like that. It allows people with overlapping values and interests to come together in a much more defined way and in a way where they can be rewarded and categorized together, but officially with no questions, authenticated. And I think that's where the NFT technology is really, really important, where you can say, I know who owns and who has expressed an interest in this club or in this team or in this league or something else based on who owns these NFTs. And musicians can reward their fans, teams can reward their fans, artists can reward collectors and define them and invite them to real life events. And I think that's all super valuable and exciting. So definitely agree with you. And again, looking forward to the time when the community shines through over and above the financial side of it. But to answer your question. So yeah, appreciate you leading into that. So early on in the Top Shot days, one of the experiences that I had and a number of other collectors had is basically you enter a new NFT space and you get really, really excited and you end up deploying a ton of capital up front and you wake up 2-3 weeks later and you're like, I need to pay a bill. I'm interested in making, in trying other NFTs. I really, really need access to liquidity or cash. And I either don't want to or I can't sell my underlying NFT. And so what used to happen in Top Shot world, especially before you can withdraw from the platform, is people would say, hey, I have a LeBron James Top Shot moment. It's worth, let's call it $1,000. I'll send that to you. You send me $500. I'll send you back $550. And then you send me back the LeBron James moment. And it's basically a collateralized loan. The issue with that, of course, is that it relies on a lot of trust and a lot of things to work out well. So even if one side of the equation is a trustworthy individual, they may have a medical issue. They may lose the access to their keys. They may forget. And there may be just complications around people completing the transaction. And so I basically went out and said, let's formalize this concept and build a company using this basic feature as sort of a launching pad. And so we basically went out and built Floaty to address this issue. And the primary issue, just to put a bow on it, is I own NFTs which have financial value to them. I need access to liquidity or cash. I don't want to or I can't sell NFTs. How do I get cash? And in the regular world, we'll call it, or traditional world, if you own a house and you need to buy lunch or you need to pay an expense or you want to buy a gift or you want to make another investment, you can go get a mortgage, which is basically a loan against your house. If you don't pay back the loan, they can come and seize your house. You can do the same things with stocks, where you can borrow on margin. If I own Apple stock or Amazon stock and it's held in a brokerage, I can borrow against that. If you own art, you can borrow against it. If you own sports cards, you can borrow against them. If you own basic tokens, Bitcoin, Ethereum, any ERC-20, you can borrow against that. What's not that easy to do is to take NFTs and borrow against them. There are some solutions, but there aren't fantastic options right now. And in the Flow ecosystem, which is where we're focused, there are no options right now. There are no lending protocols. There are no lending platforms. There are no DeFi platforms. There's nothing on Flow right now. And so I think what we're trying to address is to fill that void, to allow people who have, especially those who have seen significant value increases on their investments, to essentially be able to enjoy and access real life benefits from the appreciation of their assets without having to sell their assets. And That's kind of what we're building. I'm happy to kind of touch into the mechanics of it and what we're hoping to build in the future. But I'll turn it back over to you.
I appreciate it. And it's a great overview of what you guys are building. I definitely think it's the beginning of a big new space in the DeFi and NFT world. And just to dive deeper into the mechanics, how does that work in practice? I guess the biggest question for the audience that opens up would be, I have a NFT that I want to borrow against. So I want to deposit it as a collateral and get some cash to pay my expenses, pay my rent, whatever. How is the value of that NFT determined and basically the parameters of the loan?
So it's a really good question and one we get pretty often. And so the answer is we are letting the market determine how to handle all this. And so the mechanics of the platform work that if you're a borrower, if you're someone who owns NFTs and you want to take out a loan against your NFTs, you basically connect to our platform. You're presented with an inventory of your NFTs. You select one of them, and then you basically input loan parameters. So you input the amount you want to borrow, the interest rate you're willing to pay, and the length of the loan that'll be outstanding. And so to your question, how does someone determine the loan amount? That should be based on the value of the underlying asset. What we are encouraging our users to do is basically say, make an assessment on the value of your NFT. You know the underlying market. There are other platforms around, there are many, many, many platforms that analyze NFTs and provide NFT valuations. Rely on those, and then decide on a loan amount. And essentially what's going to happen then is after you upload your listing to a marketplace, you've chosen your loan amount, your interest rate, and your duration, it gets uploaded to a marketplace. And then lenders, who are a second cohort of people here who have capital and are looking for a return on their capital, can go to the marketplace and evaluate your listing. And so if you have a $1,000 LeBron James moment that would conventionally be viewed as $1,000 and you're looking to borrow $1,800, it's very unlikely that a lender will come along and fill that loan. And so what's going to happen naturally is if you want to get a loan, you need to make an adjustment. You need to lower your loan amount from $1,800 to something below $1,000. You need to maybe increase your interest rate. And eventually the market will kind of reach standards where we know the approximate standard is you can borrow around 50% of the value of your asset and maybe pay 5 to 10% per 30 days that you want the loan outstanding. And that's just a guess. We'll see, it depends on the lender's willingness to make loans at those levels. It depends on the underlying NFT itself, the risk of the asset. And importantly, just finishing up in terms of how it works. So the borrower adds the listing to the marketplace. The lender comes along and fills the loan, and then the timer starts. And so if it's a 30-day loan, the borrower has 30 days to repay the loan, pay back the principal plus interest. And if they do, the NFT automatically gets transferred back into their account. If they don't pay by loan maturity, then the lender receives the NFT instead. And it all happens automatically. And that's where there's no trust between the parties. It doesn't matter who the different parties are. The lender makes an analysis on the NFT itself and says, what do I think is the risk that the underlying NFT falls below the loan value during the term of this loan? And if they think it's low and they think the interest rate compensates them enough for that risk, then they can go ahead and fund that loan. And so the lender needs to understand the NFT market, and standards will evolve where lenders will come along with their capital and vote with their capital and basically say, this type of loan structure doesn't work for us. I don't want to fill this loan. And then that borrower might say, okay, I need to lower the loan amount, increase the interest rate, shorten the term, and the market will dictate basically. But we as a platform don't take a view on valuation. We will present data to our users. So 3 months in, 6 months into our beyond our launch, we'll have a lot of transaction data available where we can say to borrowers and lenders, here is the level at which this NFT has historically borrowed against and lenders have filled. And here are the kind of types of loans that lenders seem to like. And people can use that information to make better educated decisions.
Awesome. Appreciate your diving deep. And walking us through the mechanics. I have a couple of questions on those. First one is, how do liquidations work? So basically, if the borrower fails to pay in the amount, does the lender receive the NFT that was used as a collateral?
Yeah, so it's a good question. A lot of lending protocols, especially on Ethereum, have margin calls or liquidation events based on the value of the underlying collateral. So if you're borrowing into Ethereum or Bitcoin, it falls below a certain level, you would basically have a forced sale of your assets to pay down the loan to get back to a certain loan to value level, essentially. Floaty's a little bit different in the sense that nothing will trigger an early payback of the loan. If the underlying asset value falls, that's the lender's risk. So basically there are two different outcomes. If the borrower has that, let's call it 30-day period to repay the principal and interest amount, it's possible if they say the NFT is now worth less than the loan amount, they basically say, I don't want to repay. And at that point, the loan will expire and the lender will receive the NFT. They'll receive the collateral instead of getting paid back their principal and interest. And that'll be the end of the loan. And so the two outcomes from the lender perspective are either they receive their capital back with interest or they receive the collateral. From the borrower's perspective, either they repay the principal plus interest and receive the NFT, or they keep the original loan and lose their NFT. But there's no liquidation event. The only two triggers for an NFT leaving the smart contract would be a repayment or an expiration of a loan, or the loan reaches maturity.
Got it. This makes a lot of sense. And you touched briefly on basically you guys providing data on how the NFT has performed in terms of loans and how it has been valued over time. But I guess another data point that you guys could provide going forward is kind of like credit scores for borrowers. Is that something that you guys have in mind? Are you already working on it?
So it's something we're thinking about doing. What we think is almost a safer way to think about this is that the lender should almost look exclusively at the collateral. And the reason I say that is because the platform is decentralized and anonymous, if we introduce credit score as a metric, what a nefarious or malicious actor could do is transact with themselves and, you know, pay back loans to themselves over and over and over again to build up a very high credit score, ask for a very, very aggressive loan. And then a third party fills that loan seeing a very attractive credit score and they never plan on paying it back. And so we are very conscious of the risks that come along with us not monitoring who our lenders and borrowers are and the fact that they're anonymous and people could multi-wallet and affect the data that comes along with the loans. And so we encourage our lenders focus on the collateral, not the counterparty. If you're comfortable with the collateral, it doesn't matter who's on the other side, because if the person doesn't pay back, you get collateral, which is hopefully worth more than your loan value. If they do pay back, great, you earned interest return. If you start introducing metrics like what you're describing, it really adds to the vulnerability of the platform, and people can take advantage of it and manipulate their scores.
Yep. No, this makes a lot of sense. And I'm glad that you answered this question. Now I have, I guess, the bigger picture in my head, and it all makes sense. So obviously, Floaty is working on lending a borrowing against NFTs as collateral. And this is one part of just this whole DeFi or decentralized finance market created around NFTs. What are the other things that you see emerging in the next months or 1 or 2 years? Like, obviously, on our end, something we're working on in EnterDAO is renting and leasing of land in metaverse games, which is, so land is a kind of NFT, as in, like, the technology behind this is still NFTs. And this is one thing, but I'm curious to basically pick your brain and get it from you. What do you see emerging in terms of DeFi and NFTs over the next year or so?
Yeah, so it's a good question. I mean, this taps into kind of my financial background. So from a Floaty perspective, some of the things we're thinking about exploring, and I do want to put a disclaimer out there that we need to explore the legal ramifications, the regulatory side of things. So these are things that we're exploring. We don't know if any of these will actually happen ourselves, but we are looking at the idea of renting NFTs, and the way we'd accomplish that, we've got a few ideas, but don't want to get too much into the specifics. But the idea would be that in NBA Top Shot world specifically, and a lot of other platforms, but since we're on Flow, that's a big part of our focus. There are challenges. There will ultimately be a video game, and there might be times where basically someone who's a bigger collector, maybe like myself or some of the other friends I have on the platform, may not need all of their assets. Someone else may need an asset but doesn't want to buy it outright. And so there might be a lease or rental opportunity there, and we can help facilitate that. So I think, you mentioned that from a land context. I do think from an NFT context, that makes sense. And I always try and connect things back to real life examples. So people, like the friends you mentioned early on asking about YouTube, how can we put it in terms that people might say, oh, that makes sense? When you rent a car, for example, when you lease a car, you don't outright own it. And part of the reason you didn't buy it is because you might not have $50,000 lying around to buy a car, but you do have $300 for monthly payments or whatever your monthly payments might be. Or you're in a city that isn't yours and you don't want to own it the next week. You want to give it right back. So that's comparable to a challenge for NBA Top Shot example. I don't want to own this Draymond Green moment for a month. I just need it for 24 hours. And I'm willing to pay a premium for that. I've lost my headphones here.
You're getting heated.
See if this works. All right, you can still hear me, right?
Yep, all good.
Okay, so I'm going to finish out what I'm saying, and then hopefully I can get my headphones fixed up.
Sure.
So that is on the rental side of things. We're also considering introducing futures contracts. So in normal commodity world, things like corn and oil and grains and tons of other commodity products, precious metals, and even like currencies, you can do futures contracts, which is basically essentially a bet on how things will evolve between now and a time in the future. There are also option contracts. So there are things that are called call options, which would basically be someone saying, I own, let's say, a CryptoPunk today. Today it's worth 50 Ethereum. I will sell you the right to buy this at any time between now and 6 months from now for 60 Ethereum. And what someone on the other side of that might be betting on is, okay, I'm going to buy that right for 2 ETH. And if this CryptoPunk goes up to 80 ETH, for example, I can then buy it for 60, sell it for 80, and I've made 20 ETH on my 2 ETH investment. And so it's basically a different way to invest in the market. And it's a financial product, it's a derivative. And so I think that's a really interesting thing that exists in normal financial markets, but doesn't really exist in the NFT world today. Obviously, fractionalization is another option that exists. And where that might come into play for Floaty is something we want to introduce longer term, is bulk lending. And so let's say someone wants to borrow $500,000 and no individual lender wants to lend that much, but there are 10 lenders who want to lend $50,000. We want to facilitate a concept like that. Then the question is, in a default scenario, if the borrower doesn't pay back, there's now one NFT, but there are 10 lenders. So what do you do? And there are two options that you can really do here, which is one, fractionalize the NFT and distribute 10% of the shares out to each lender, or you can immediately trigger an auction and then sell the underlying NFT and distribute out the proceeds. And so we are exploring those kinds of options, but those sort of financial tools are also interesting. Obviously, fractional.art has done a good job of kind of normalizing fractionalization and making it so there's a clear path to what they call reconstitution, which is if someone buys out the NFT, you can kind of put all the pieces back together and it becomes a single NFT again. So I think that's exciting. I mentioned auction. There's a lot of companies that are innovating, or a lot of platforms innovating, really interesting auction models. So everyone's familiar with Dutch auctions, but another example is there's an art platform on the Flow blockchain called Versus. And what they do is they basically present a piece of art, and there are two competing sides where there are people who can bid on a one-of-one version of the art, or what they call an edition version, where they might have 25 editions. And basically, they look at the top 25 bidders on the edition side. Does that number exceed what the highest one-of-one bid is? And basically, one side or the other wins at the end of the auction. So if the highest number is the one-of-one, then the one-of-one would win, and that person wins the auction. If the highest number is the top 25 bids on the edition side, the sum of all those, then it would go become a 25 out of 25 edition piece of art. And so those kinds of innovative things are pretty exciting in this space. And you know, I know you've expressed quite a few things before in EnterDAO about what you guys are exploring, and you know, we've touched on a few of those, but you know, would love to turn it back to you to hear a bit more about what you guys are thinking about and how you guys are basically taking real life financialization and applying it to NFTs from the land standpoint.
I appreciate the insights, and I definitely think all of these things that you mentioned make sense. I'll give you my basically 2 cents on land, and they wanted to dive a bit deeper on renting of NFTs in general. So our thesis behind EnterDAO and Landworks Dairies is that it's essentially real estate in the metaverse and advertising space in the metaverse, and brands and projects would want to use that for events and for advertising, but they don't need to own this land long term in order to leverage it for the audiences. And what we try to enable is basically period-based renting of metaverse land, which would enable the people that have rented the land to basically build and deploy scenes, buildings, events, whatever on it. This is what we're building there. Quite excited about that. And I wanted to touch back on the renting part of side of things, especially around collections and collectibles, like whether is it Topshot and CryptoPunks or whatever, just trying to play devil's advocate, like what do you think is the utility behind it in terms of application? Because there has been quite a bit of pushback on this concept on Twitter and everywhere, because a lot of people collect NFTs just to be part of something and to flex that they own something. And some people look at flexing an NFT that is not yours, that you have rented, as a bad look. Do you agree with this, or what do you think is the real world utility of renting all of these digital collectibles?
Yes, so I think there's two answers here. One is that even though it may not be something that I do or you do, there are lots and lots of people in the world who might rent a Lamborghini for 3 days because like they want to exude wealth and feel that and drive by a restaurant and have everyone look at them and make a lot of noise when they're driving down the street and whatever it is, even though it's not theirs. And so, you know, the flex may be sufficient for them to basically say, you know, I own this for a temporary amount of time and I'm with a certain group and want to show that I own it to that certain group. And then after that, I'm less focused on that. Now, I think that's probably a secondary use in our world. And it's a harder thing to apply because, you know, if you rent a Lamborghini, you get a Lamborghini. If you rent a CryptoPunk, you know, you get the image that everyone else gets where they can Google it. So where I think it's much more applicable and what we're trying to tap into at Floaty is the concept of if you own this NFT over a certain time frame, you get other utility tied to it. So, you know, I mentioned Topshot before. They have challenges. They have maybe real life benefits where they might say, if you own these 10 Knicks moments, you get tickets for tonight's Knicks game. And, you know, someone might be a collector in Thailand who has a Julius Randle Knicks moment who might say to someone, do you want to rent this for 24 hours? Pay me $10. It's cheaper for you than going to buy it for $100 in the marketplace. I can't use it anyway. It saves you some money. You don't want to own it after today anyway. And you would get access to the Knicks game for a much cheaper level at that point. And so I think that idea is really, really helpful, especially as more utility is added around these NFTs. And it gives the NFT collectors far more actual value out of their NFT. If, for example, you buy a pass from a band, that allows you to go to any concert they have for that year around the world. And you can maybe go to the one in New York and Chicago and Paris, but you can't go to the one in Johannesburg, South Africa. You can't go to the one in Sydney, Australia. You can then rent out the NFT to someone, which is basically the same idea as selling a ticket, which allows you to get some capital back, allows someone else to enjoy the concert experience at a cheaper price. And it makes collecting NFTs from, you know, from a collection standpoint more valuable because you can financialize them, as we've been talking about. You can rent them out. You can get some capital off the table, even if they're not bringing utility to you at that moment. They might be bringing utility to someone else. So I think that's the far more applicable example than the temporary flex, which some people may like. It's a big world. Some people may just want to own a CryptoPunk for a few days. Maybe they're going on a first date and want to flex it on their phone. Who knows? There's a lot of people in the world.
Yeah. No, I appreciate this. And I hadn't thought it from that point of view, especially in the Top Shot example. And if we move to, I guess, now that I think of it, if we move to like these other collectibles, like all these avatar collections, like a lot of these are used as like mint passes for other collections and stuff like that. So this is another use case that can be used now that I think of it. Awesome. So we've talked about basically all these new financial products emerging that are relatively sophisticated around NFTs. But in the beginning, you mentioned that the industry still has quite a bit of room in terms of maturity and moving from all like the hype and financial upside to the actual utility and like maturity of the industry. What do you think are the biggest challenges ahead of NFTs right now? Obviously, over the past years, of the past 1 year and like the whole JPEG summer and everything, there has been a plethora of projects that, to be quite frank, will probably die over the next 12 or 24 months and a lot of noise will be cleared out. Which I think could be a good thing, but what do you think are the biggest challenges right now in front of NFTs? So it kind of legitimizes itself as a legit space in a legit financial market for the wider audience.
Yes, I think there are, I'm just taking a note here. I think there are two kind of categories I would touch on. The first one is a very unexciting topic, but I do think it's really important, which is the regulatory side of things. So a lot of NFTs are sort of playing in a gray area right now, especially the ones that are issuing tokens and things like that, and doing things that would conventionally require licenses to do or certifications to do. And it's complicated because a lot of, you know, full decentralized platforms, there's no company behind it. So who do regulators talk to? What do they do? If they wanted to fine someone, what do? They can't shut it down. So there's no, basically a lot of NFT and crypto and blockchain world doesn't fit neatly into today's laws. So the question is, how do laws progress going forward? Does, you know, a country like the US, who's pretty strict with things like this, so they basically say, if you interact with these platforms, you're breaking the law, even though, you know, we can't find the platform, we can find you though. And it's very possible that people take a stronger view on that. We've seen what China does. We've seen India do it before. And part of what we're trying to get through as a community and an ecosystem here is we're fighting an uphill battle because the governments and the local municipalities are threatened by the idea of us taking away one of the primary functions of government, which is organizing currency and organizing commerce. And we're, you know, what the ecosystem is doing right now is basically saying, we don't need you for that. And we don't need middlemen for auctions. We don't need a Sotheby's or a Christie's, even though they're trying to get involved. We can just do auctions with trustless smart contracts. And I think it kind of threatens the incumbency a little bit. And I mean, the reality of the situation is it's progress, and progress has casualties along the way. And if the casualties are partially government control, but it's for the better of everyone, and it allows more commerce to be done without, you know, without restrictions and just more of a free market, I think that's a positive, but it's going to take a long time for governments to get comfortable with that. So I think the regulatory side of it is a huge hurdle. I think then probably more in line with what you were looking for here is on the adoption side of it. So there are a lot of people who still don't see the value of digital assets. And it goes back to the first question you asked, where it's, what am I actually buying here? And I don't think it takes very long for people to spend time in the space and see you are genuinely getting access to communities. You're buying these scarce products that people really value and really want to own. The world is going increasingly digital. And so, you know, I actually bought a piece of art, of NFT art, I want to say 6 months ago, and it came along with a physical piece by the same artist. And the physical piece, I've basically stored in my closet. I haven't looked at it once, but I, you know, showcased the NFT piece. You know, I've put out links about it. It's attached to my profile. What'd you say?
It's like my university diploma, you know.
Yeah, there you go, just stuck in the closet. And so I think that it's something, because it makes so much sense to people who have spent time in the space, and because there is, you know, true utility that can be attached to NFTs and these communities we talked about before, that I don't think it's going to be that big of an issue or that hard to overcome. It'll just take time. And as people kind of overcome their premonitions about the space or their preconceived notions and give it a chance, I think people will genuinely see the value of it. And some people will always hesitate to get involved, but this, look, there are always people. We don't need 100% of people to like art or collecting stamps. There are communities for these things that form. And I think the NFT space makes a ton of sense for all people involved, collectors, speculators, artists, bands, sports teams, leagues. That I think it'll just keep growing. And, you know, what I hope happens, as we've talked about before, is that it becomes less of a casino and more of kind of an art culture type of experience where, you know, the NFT world, you know, becomes what I think a lot of people in the space want it to, which is another way to express yourself and to form communities.
Oh, for sure. No, I'm with you 100%, and I agree on both these points that you touched. And I think this has, we can use this as basically as a good wrap up of the discussion we've had. I know we're 45 minutes deep and I don't want to keep you on for too long, but I think, at least for me, this has been one of the most insightful discussions I've had on NFTs, as you, as one of these people that are deep into the trenches and have been so over the past couple of years. So big thank you for being on the show. And quick last question. Is Float in life right now, or where should we expect it?
So first of all, thank you very much for having me on. Always enjoy our conversations. I have a ton of respect for you. And before I answer anything else, I do want to note that this is a Lime Chain, a Splash of Lime show, and Lime Chain are the brains behind our smart contract and have been a fantastic group to work with. We've been working with the Lime Chain group for, I'd say, eight or nine months at this point, and it's been an awesome experience. We feel very fortunate to have crossed paths. So a big thank you to you and your team, Zivko. And remind me, what was the question you posed there?
So, yeah, I just want to touch on, is Float in life right now? So
okay.
I don't know the answer, but just for the people out
there. Yeah, of course. I appreciate that. So we're recording this on November 30th. We are hoping to launch in the very near future. We have a date circled as early as next week, but I do want to, you know, just note the timeline does change. There are legal things to work through. There are different NFT collections we want to onboard to Floaty, and there are a lot of different parties and a lot of different moving parts. So our goal is to launch as early as next week. It could slip another week or two beyond that, but we very much hope to be up and running before the end of 2021. And so we're excited about it. We're excited to bring the tools to the community and excited for people to experience a lot of what we've been talking about here today.
Yep. No, I definitely think this is amazing. I'm quite excited to see all this come to fruition. Once again, big thank you for being on the show, and a big thank you for enduring my shitposting on almost daily basis. You're one of those people that need that happen to endure my shitposting regularly. So
I do
appreciate it for not kicking me out of the Telegram chat. Thank you, Mike. Been a great discussion. Super excited to see Floaty live and basically to grow together as an industry and as a community.
Well, thank you very much. Really, really appreciate it. And I'll talk to you soon.
Yep. Thank you.